Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Tonight, we are going to do something a little bit different. You all know or have heard of John Dillinger. And we did a little bit of stuff on John Dillinger. I've got some more to do on him. I think he's a fascinating character. Public enemy number one at one point in time in the 1930s. Robbed banks all over the Midwest.
Chicago Tribune, Wednesday, April 25th, 1934. Officers said to be closing in on bandits. Officers have orders to shoot on sight. Apprehension felt that the mob may attempt to free their pals. 5,000 police officers in five states, every one of them armed to the teeth, were heartened tonight with the word of federal authorities that the end of John Dillinger's bloody trail was in sight. Government men in charge of the manhunt reviewed their accomplishments in tracking Dillinger during the past week and declared it only a matter of days, perhaps hours, before the outlaw would be killed or captured. Telephone calls, telegrams, and personal visits from citizens came at the rate of hundreds an hour to the anti-crime directors in half a dozen cities, reporting Dillinger to be here, there, everywhere. In Wisconsin, Minnesota, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois. From the many scraps of information reaching them, authorities sifted out what they believed to be of value and deduced that Dillinger and two or more of his outlaws had reached Minnesota in the neighborhood of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Another group of the seven Dillinger outlaws fleeing after northern Wisconsin gun battles that cost two lives were believed to have gone in the opposite direction. Watches were kept for them in Indiana, Ohio, and Illinois.
Well, it was ever all hands on deck kind of a deal to find John Dillinger. And
did they say 500 officers?
5,000.
5,000?
Yes, 5,000.
In five states.
Yeah.
That's pretty much every single officer who's on the force.
Pretty much most of them that you could count. I don't know how many Chicago policemen they had back then, but I guess you wouldn't have all the Chicago PD on it.
Opportunity for some other crime to be taken care of.
Really?
Now that the cops are so busy looking for Dillinger, all of them are doing it.
So five, yeah, but they were out, you know, like they caught... they shot up those other guys, the wrong guys, and they thought they had Dillinger. So you better not get mistaken for Dillinger. And every time somebody committed a crime, they thought it was John Dillinger. So
yeah, well, the fact that they said that they were given the order that they could shoot on sight, I think they already knew that.
I think they did too. Can you imagine today order going out, shoot on sight to the police? Can you imagine that?
I don't know how they could do that.
Oh. I could think
of how they do it. They wouldn't tell the reporters.
Right. You wouldn't. Back then, you'd tell the reporters. Today, you just don't tell the reporters.
Telling the Chicago Tribune we can shoot on sight.
We had a rash of bank robbers when I was young in my police career. Mm-hmm. Early in my police career. And he wasn't the chief yet. He was a commander of the investigations unit. We put together a squad. Special squad of detectives and a SWAT team, I think, to be part of it. And I was part of that squad to try to catch these guys and stop them from robbing banks. They're like robbing one about every 2 weeks. I believe in retrospect it was the Kelton brothers, Terry and Jerry Kelton, or some of their crew. They had like a whole crew that was going out doing dope and had a cold heroin operation going and had a bank robbery crew and a variety of other crimes. They had kind of like a little black mafia going for a while. I'll leave him nameless. His son's still on the police department, just achieved the rank of major, but this guy, he was the chief of detectives, and he talked to us in a squad room, and we were getting ready to go out and take up surveillance on different banks and the ones that we projected might do it, and had some of the other detectives are going out running down leads, and a lot of us were just sitting on banks waiting for somebody to come. And he basically said he didn't really want these guys robbing any more banks if we caught them. Now, you could take that however you want, but we kind of took it that, you know.
Wait a second. If you catch them, if you catch them, they're not going to rob any more banks,
well,
right?
Yeah, but they might get out of jail. They might get out on bond.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I know, you know, we but knew,
you,
we all
knew what
he
really meant.
We all knew what he really meant. You need to pop these dudes. But I'm sure they don't do that anymore. You know, they're chasing around after Dillinger like crazy, and he's going to go on to do more crimes. But they, all bets were off trying to find John Dillinger, as you can tell.
It seems interesting, you have to think about this in terms of the era. You know, when they say there were hundreds of calls per hour.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't like people had cell phones.
Right.
They you
and
know.
There wasn't like a 1-800 John Dillinger
number.
Call either.
Yeah, there wasn't, you know, all they had was some radio and the print newspaper.
Right.
And I don't know how you're like, you know, and then they're like, it's Illinois, it's Minnesota, it's
South
Iowa,
Dakota.
South Dakota. Everywhere, like all over the place, people are seeing John Dillinger.
Right, and they're calling in.
Any car that comes through their community that isn't from there.
Yeah, and if it's a guy about 30 years old and even has any kind of a close look to him, they think that may be John Dillinger.
Yeah, especially if he's driving a sheriff's police car.
Yeah, well,
maybe he had ditched that by that point.
I think he ditched that pretty quick. You know, play this next clip. It's kind of interesting. I didn't really realize this until I started going through this, that a black man was captured up with Dillinger.
Chicago Tribune, Friday, March 16th, 1934. John Dillinger's Negro companion slain in Michigan. Herbert Youngblood, fatally wounded in battle with sheriff's force in Port Huron. Sarnia, Ontario, Royal Canadian Mounted Police rushed to a patrol of the riverbank here when it was reported a white man believed to be John Dillinger had crossed from the United States in a rowboat. The hunt for John Dillinger, escaped desperado, grew hot again when Herbert Youngblood, his Negro companion in their sensational break from the Crown Point, Indiana jail, was fatally wounded at Port Huron, Michigan. Before he fell with several bullets in his body, the Negro gunman wounded three officers who had come to investigate him, ignorant of his identity. Youngblood, facing a murder charge for a Gary, Indiana slaying, admitted his identity as he lay dying. He died in a hospital a few hours after he was wounded. Deputy Sheriffs Charles Cavanaugh and Howard Lord were near death. Sheriff William Van Antwerp was shot through the shoulder. An unidentified Negro, who pointed Youngblood out to the sheriff as a very tough guy you ought to check up on, suffered a bullet wound in his leg. "I'm Herb Youngblood," the gunman gasped before he lost consciousness from his wounds. Later, still insisting on his identity, he told police Dillinger and two companions have been in southeastern Michigan for 3 days. Immediately, every law enforcement officer in that corner of the state was mobilized in a manhunt which spread over a block of territory 100 miles square. The Canadian border was strongly guarded. Blockades were thrown across highways leading out of Port Huron. The state police converged their cars on Detroit and blocked the Toledo highways into Ohio. Captain Matt Leach of the Indiana State Police arrived from Crown Point at 12:30. The Negro desperado, police said, was armed with only one handgun, an automatic. In his hideout, police could find no evidence that anyone else had been with him. The machine gun he took from the Crown Point jail when he and Dillinger made their wooden pistol escape March 3rd was not found. The wounded Negro informer, whose name police did not know, came to the sheriff and reported there was a very tough colored boy hiding out down in the Abrams grocery store building. Youngblood was pierced by three shots when the battle that ensued when Sheriff William L. Van Antwerp led two of his deputies into the store where the Negro was staying. Opening the door, the men rushed in. Youngblood fired blindly. The officers returned the shots. Deputy Charles Lohrstorfer, fourth officer left on guard outside, heard the firing, saw Cavanaugh stagger through the doorway a few feet, then collapse. Lohrstorfer dashed into the room. The firing had ceased. Propped against a counter stood the sheriff, his revolver trained on the bleeding body of the Negro, who was lying on the floor a few feet away. At the sheriff's feet lay Deputy Lohr, clutching his side. The three seriously wounded and the sheriff were rushed to the hospital, where surgeons prepared emergency operations to save their lives. Taken to a hospital, the Negro said he was Youngblood and that Dillinger and three other men had been with him in Southport, Huron. When hospital attendants washed his face, they found a scar on each cheek, hidden by burnt cork. This led officers to believe that possibly Dillinger has been masquerading as a Negro. Every exit from Southport, Huron immediately was placed under guard by the sheriff's officers, state police, and local police, and other officers began a systematic combing of the suburb in search of the fugitive's hideout. An assistant prosecutor with a stenographer remained at the Negro's bedside to question the dying man should he become conscious. In one moment of consciousness, he said that while he had not been with Dillinger for several days, he had seen the notorious fugitive last night. State police reported at noon one of their cruisers had chased and lost near Port Huron a car believed to be carrying Dillinger and two companions. Though the first cruiser lost the quarry, Detroit headquarters said the dozen other cars in the vicinity had been notified and were expected to pick up the trail.
Well, that was one tough black dude there, wasn't it? Herbert Youngblood. I'd not heard this before, that he was an escapee with Dillinger and wanted for murder and ended up in a big shootout with the Michigan police. It said that it sounded like he killed two of them for sure and said they were in bad shape.
Yeah, three of them were shot. I don't know. It was interesting because they kind of state that at the beginning part and then they kind of wind back through the story and the telling in the newspaper article. And then when it comes to when they actually went to the store that the other Negro had said this guy's hiding out at, the newspaper report says that he blindly shot at them. Except Herbert Youngblood is a blind shot, hit three people. Doesn't sound like it was such a blind shot.
Really?
I mean, these guys, you know, they're certainly putting their lives on the line with anybody who they have to deal with that might be a gang member with John Dillinger. Now, some of these other guys who can shoot three, four rounds and not hit anybody, you know, like earlier in the story.
It's a heck of a story, and you know, this is the end of it for now. He's going to get away, and he's going to do some more crimes. We've got another one we're going to bring you about the Battle of Little Bohemia. He's going to hook up with Babyface Nelson's gang, and who is a man named Homer Van Meter, Tommy Carroll, and Eddie Green. They will engage in another shootout in which I believe an FBI agent's killed, and some of the gang gets killed. You know, we all kind of know the lady in red and that Melvin Purvis shot him outside the Biograph Theater, but all this other stuff, between the time he broke out of the jail at the Crown Point Jail, there was every law enforcement officer in the Midwest practically was beating the bushes for John Dillinger and John Dillinger's gang. I read one place where it's kind of like the bloom was off the rose. The people had had enough of John Dillinger and robbing banks, and he'd kind of lost some of his status as a folk hero and a Robin Hood kind of a guy. Probably couldn't find anybody that actually helped out with his money he took out of these banks other than himself. He's gonna hook up with.
They didn't find any money in Herbert Youngblood.
No, they didn't. They did find. They must have gone someplace. They probably took some guns out of the sheriff's office, but I think they also found some guns somewhere else. I believe there's a story where they did some kind of a raid on another police station or something, and got some guns. So they'd gotten some guns, and obviously they had split up by then. Now, he claims that Dillinger was there, but later on he will retract that claim that Dillinger was anywhere around. But somehow he and Dillinger split up, and he went his way, and Dillinger went his way. Just kind of interesting that he would even take a black man along with him, because you talk about a black man and a white man in 1934 driving down the road in a car. You talk about probable cause, something sticking out like a sore thumb to a policeman. There would be no way to drive by a policeman in 1934 looking like that out in the country, especially.
Even in the North.
Even in the North. That just would have been unheard of and really unusual.
And, let alone a black and a white man in a rowboat.
In a rowboat, yeah.
Going across, I guess, like Lake Huron or something.
I guess the black man was by himself by then. I'm sure they split up pretty quick. Wonder if Dillinger, they didn't talk about getting any money off him. Wonder if Dillinger gave him any money. I don't know if he even had any money yet by then. If he had a chance to rob a bank, he went back to robbing banks pretty quick to get some money.
I'm kind of curious if there isn't more story about Herbert Youngblood somewhere as a criminal, although not as famous as John Dillinger.
No, you know, I wasn't finding anything at all about Herbert Youngblood other than, you know, his one brush with fame and glory was John Dillinger.
Was this.
Of course, back in those times, and he had to have been a master arch criminal if he was a black man. Otherwise, they would not even bother to report it. Yeah, if you notice in the popular culture, have you ever heard of that before, that a black man escaped jail with John Dillinger? I never heard that before.
Didn't know that.
And you know, the big headline was...
trying to remember the movie with Johnny Depp. I don't know if I remember that. Wasn't that the movie where Johnny Depp played John Dillinger?
Yeah, but I think that was only at the end. I'll have to look that movie up. They've got one about the Battle of Little Bohemia with Warren Oates and some other character actors. But the Johnny Depp Dillinger, I can't... I probably saw that at the time, but I can't remember. I have to go back and take a look at that. He's going to get hooked up pretty quick with Billy Frenchette, who's a woman who eventually betray him, get hooked up with Babyface Nelson's gang and start robbing banks again and head inexorably towards his demise. The next story we report on will be the Battle of Little Bohemia with John Dillinger, Babyface Nelson, Homer Van Meter, and two or three other names you never heard of. On his gang and Melvin Purvis, who you probably have heard of, and a contingent of FBI agents, local police out of Wisconsin. They had gone up to a lodge to hide out for a few days, and it was called Little Bohemia. So it's quite an exciting story. We will get back to that later, folks.
You do have one more audio clip here. It's entitled The Bulletproof Vest.
Oh, you know, I thought there was something else in there. Play that one, Aaron. That's where I knew there was something about him getting stealing some guns and stuff. So play that one.
All right.
Chicago Tribune, Friday, April 13th, 1934. Bulletproof vests taken from jail. Warsaw policeman forced to admit Dillinger to police station. Warsaw, Indiana, April 13th. John Dillinger, America's most notorious outlaw, returned to his old stomping grounds today for a new raid on a police arsenal and barely escaped capture. The criminal, with a companion identified as Homer Van Meter, Indiana parole violator and known associate of the marauding Dillinger, fled southwest with a posse of 50 vigilantes close upon his heels. Dillinger appeared on the deserted streets of Warsaw early this morning, where he and his companion confronted Judd Pittinger, night patrolman and former chief of police. With automatic pistols shoved against his sides, Pittinger was forced to lead the two desperados to the city building and police headquarters. Van Meter held Pittinger against a wall while Dillinger picked up three bulletproof vests and two pistols from the police lockers. "Let's take the old boy along with us so he won't squawk too soon," Dillinger said. "Okay," his partner replied. This was too much for Pittinger. The trio was making its way down a flight of stairs from the second floor police office with Dillinger following and Van Meter leading the way. Pittinger kicked at the bandit's shins behind him and tripped him. Dillinger pitched forward, spilling the bulletproof vests atop the other two men, and all three rolled to the foot of the stairs. The noise awakened the night driver of the fire truck, which is housed in the city building, and he ran to the front of the building. Dillinger picked up the bulletproof vests and guns and leaped for a large blue sedan which was parked at the front of the building and made their escape.
Well, now that was after he'd escaped. This was after he'd separated from Youngblood and after he'd hooked up with the Pretty Boy Floyd gang because Homer Van Meter was part of that. So they were getting tooled up, shall we say, to go on some more bank robbery sprees. This is before the Battle of Little Bohemia. And those weapons and those bulletproof vests and everything they got that night will come into play at that point in time when we come back with this story again. So I'm glad you found that, Aaron. I knew I had something like that, and I
I had that in the stack, and as you were going through and queuing me, I just was like, well, you were kind of wrapping up, and I'm like, oh, wait a second, there's one more audio clip here of a reading that was done by Paul Kim.
Right. Paul Kim, our good friend Paul Kim, actor, former policeman. You know, Paul got involved in a shootout himself, and I think it was a domestic violence situation. I can't remember exactly. He was a young policeman. I knew him. I was a desk sergeant, and he first came on dog watch. Got to know him then. He's a really good, nice young guy, and moved on and went to another station, got on days, and kind of forgotten about Paul Kim. Then I heard he got hurt a little bit in the shootout, and the next thing I knew, I'd kind of forgotten about him, and I ran into him in some kind of I was at some kind of a film thing, and I find out that he's now... he's left the police department. He's got some other kind of a job, but he's also acting. He's had a part on Chicago Police, Chicago Fire. He does commercials all the time. You ever see he's an Asian guy. Paul Kim is Korean, kind of unusual. We don't have that many Asian officers in Kansas City. Probably do in San Francisco and New York City, but we don't have that big Asian population. But he's an Asian Korean police officer. He'll play. If you see a Korean doctor for, I think it's the KU Med Center, advertisement, it'll be Paul Kim. And I've seen him on a couple other ads. He stays busy. Probably it's not enough to leave his day job yet, but he's going to get a little exposure with his voice reading skills here, and we wish him luck. I hope
he's working on a book, isn't he?
Well, he said he is. He's working on some kind of I don't know if it's a novel or a story of his own experience, maybe out of that shootout. He's never really said it's something to do with the police. I know that. He's gotten to know several people up there on the staff at that. Is it Chicago Police or Chicago PD is the name of that
TV show?
He's gotten to know several people up there and is pretty friendly with them, trying to get more parts with them. I'd like to see him get something going.
Well, in that last read that he did, I'm wondering. When John Dillinger went up on the second floor of this police department.
Right.
And, I guess nobody's there, just the guy from the fire department downstairs.
Right.
And they get bulletproof vests. Well, this is, 1934?
Yeah, and they have bulletproof vests in some small police, one-man, two-person police department.
But they're probably not, bulletproof vests like you think of today.
No, they were...
They're not Kevlar. They're probably... these vests with big steel plates in
right.
them.
Right. I think that's what they were. They were just, cloth vest with steel plates put in them, then they'd strap them on.
Should make probably all the difference in a firefight, too, which we'll find out about later.
Yeah, depending on the bullets they use. But I think they didn't even, if they used military shells of any kind, steel jacketed shells, they'll go real cut through that. Those metal plates, or even a Kevlar vest, just like they were nothing. But if they use what we call your normal kind of your handgun shell, they'll stop them. They'll just flatten out. It'll hurt like hell and bruise you, but they'll stop them.
Won't kill you.
It won't penetrate the vest. But the steel jacketed shells out of a high-powered rifle will go right through, just like your vest wasn't even there. I think we've done John Dillinger up pretty good. I'll give my public service announcement. If you have a friend or relative or a loved one that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, addiction, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say that folks need to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app for $1.99. You can get your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City, and you can get the app. We'll have all of the episodes from the podcast in it right there at your fingertips. And while you're at it, you can buy the book, Leaving Vegas, the latest autobiography, not an autobiography. What would that be? It's not your autobiography.
No, it's just a true crime novel.
Novel from the Argent Files.
Yeah, it will. I used a lot of the wiretaps in it from the backstory behind the movie Casino. They were skimming from Las Vegas casinos, and we did a lot of wiretaps here in Kansas City. So I put the transcripts in the Kindle versions of one to get. I don't make as much money on it, make hardly any money on it, but I really want you to get the Kindle version because I want people to see how these guys work in real life. So I will explain in the book, I'll explain kind of how we got to this point and got these wiretaps and got these hidden microphones, the probable cause and how all that works. And then I'll start putting in chronological order, the buildup from the first tap to the last one before we served search warrants and arrested everybody in Chicago, Milwaukee, Cleveland, and Kansas City.
And the book actually has the transcription. You could read it, but it's not nearly as powerful as if you get the book and the Kindle.
And it, so you tap on the Kindle version, you tap on the...
There's a hyperlink.
The hyperlink on the title of the transcript, and it'll take you to a Vimeo site, which will then have the audio with captions on it, so you can read along as they say the actual words. So it truly will be a book out of the mouths of the men that did the crime that the book is about. So that's what it's about.
And of course, you need to get the documentary that started it all,
Gangland Wire.
You can buy it on Amazon.
Yeah, I just sold one the other day. First one I'd sold off my website for a while. I get a lot of streaming rentals and streaming off of YouTube. Not
you
YouTube,
can actually
but,
rent it
Amazon.
On there as well, but we encourage folks to buy it. And
to
if
buy
you want to.
So I had an autograph it for you.
Yeah, for a donation of $25 or more, you can get an autographed copy of the DVD from Gary Jenkins as long as you live in the United States. Right.
Plus, that's only $5 more than it would cost you. So, you know, such a deal. You're only making a $5 donation to Aaron and I. Anyhow, yeah, put a hit out on the donate page, as Aaron likes to say. I think he needs to copyright that. Little
hit on our donate button.
Hit out on our donate button, copyright Aaron. And what we need the help. I'm working on a case. I already got a bunch of FOIA things, and I'm working on this one. It's going to be a long, probably a 4 or 5 part story about a crime spree that went over several years and actually ended up here at Leavenworth Penitentiary in the end. It's always, for a policeman, that's always a good end to a crime story, a crime spree story, isn't it?
Doesn't involve Junior Bradley?
No, I've got, you know, I got...
It's
you know,
another story.
I know. Aaron, you should bring that up. I just got...
You know why I brought that up?
A third...
Because, when I met with Paul Howell last Sunday,
yeah.
He was the father of one of the sons that was killed by Bob Bordella.
Right.
Kind of trying to... having to circumstantially met him, tell him a little bit about the podcast and such. And it was the second time I met him and we're talking and he's throwing some names at me. And I actually did an audio recording of one of them. I have to listen to it to tell you who it is. But over the course of the time talking with him, I'm trying to remember the name of that character. And I couldn't remember it. And then finally, like almost at the end, I'm like, Junior Bradley. And he got really quiet.
Yeah, I bet, because he like does stuff at the city market, right?
Junior?
No, this Paul Howell. He has a booth or something down there?
No, I don't know. He just shows up there every
he
once
shows
in a
up
while.
Down there, but he knew Junior Bradley and who he was,
I think
didn't
so.
He?
He seemed to know there were some people that we kind of knew in common. And
yeah, he was one of them. Well, Junior Bradley was a mafia fence, the biggest mafia fence in probably the Midwest. But that's a whole nother story. I just got a third unexpected CD with a whole bunch of reports about Junior Bradley. So
a whole extra one?
A whole nother one. I don't even know where it came from. I'd forgotten.
Was
I
in
thought,
with the rest of the stuff.
Right? I don't know. I thought I'd gotten everything I could get out of them, and they sent me another one. So who knows? I guess paying them some money did help. So I'll eventually get that together. That's another big story.
That's why we need you to put a hit out on our donate button so
really?
We can get these Freedom Information Act requests. They're the most expensive thing, actually.
They are. That, and I can maybe hire an editor to edit these podcasts together, which would save me about 2 or 3 hours, probably 3 hours for every episode, practically. I'm going to write show notes and everything. But we still are going to do them. We do it for the love of it, not for the money, but... The money always helps make our jobs a little easier and increase the quality. All right. I think it's time to say goodnight, Aaron. Say goodnight.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
This is my lawyer. I respectfully refuse to answer that question. As my truthful answer may tend to incriminate me.